This podcast has never had ads or sponsors, thanks to the incredible support from our Patreon community. If you want to support independent space journalism, go to patreon.com/universetoday. What is the international protocol for a large asteroid that could hit the Earth? Will China's space program leave NASA behind soon? Can we realistically mine the moon for helium-3? In our free Q&A version on Patreon, what is my next favorite telescope after Gaia is gone? Answering all these questions and more in this question show. It's time for the question show. Your questions, my answers. As always, wherever you are across my channel, if a question pops in your brain, just write it down. I'll gather them up and I will answer them here. All right, let's get into the questions. N. McNiven, since someone asked about Musk, do you have any thoughts on the speed at which China has accelerated its space program? Do you see NASA being left behind? That's an interesting question. So China's space exploration program is stunning. That they are advancing at a rate which I had never really expected to see. I've been doing this job for 26 years, and I remember reporting on the first astronauts that China had launched, first human spaceflight, first taikonauts. And that was in the mid-2000s. And then we watched as they launched a space station, and then we watched another space station. Now they've got their new space station. But the part that sort of brought it all together for me was the emphasis they put on sending missions to the moon. They went with Chang'e 1, Chang'e 2, now we're up to Chang'e 6. They've done multiple sample return missions from the moon. They've launched to Mars. They put a rover down on the surface of Mars. They're in the process of building space telescopes, gravitational wave observatories. They've got the largest radio telescope in the world. They're building the largest steerable radio telescope in the world. They are moving quite efficiently towards their goals. And they have these really long-term goals. They are like 30-year long plans where they're just going to move through this process step after step after step. And so, you know, by in 2029, we should see the launch of their Mars sample return mission. 2027, we should see the launch of their asteroid sample return mission. 2030, we'll probably see astronauts from China walk on the moon for the first time. I would say into the late 2030s, we will probably see a permanently inhabited base on the moon populated by Chinese astronauts. Into your late 2030s, early 2040s, we should see humans go to Mars from China. And they've been hitting all their milestones. I mean, you know, they've said they were going to do things and they did them. And so, you know, you compare that to what's happening with the US. I mean, the US is still, like, you can't count out the United States. It is the most technologically capable country in the world with an enormous amount of skill and knowledge and experience in spaceflight. But it has a difficult track record in funding projects and being able to commit long, large amounts of money for long periods of time. But then it also has an incredibly vibrant private space industry with SpaceX, with Rocket Lab, with other groups that are able to launch rockets. So I think the way you should sort of look at this is that China has a roadmap. And it's freely available and it's out there on the internet and you can look at it, you can compare it, and that will tell you exactly what they're going to do and when they're going to do it. And I think that they are going to hit their milestones. They're just going to hit them all. They'll have some setbacks, but in general, they're going to accomplish all the things that they say they're going to do because, you know, they've been planning this for a long time and they've been putting in the work over and over year after year after year. I mean, they produce so many STEM people. It's kind of astonishing compared to other nations. But the US is just so good at this. They have so much skill, so much experience. And, you know, right now it's a very difficult, weird time for human space exploration, for science, space, for like science programs, but that could turn around. And so, you know, I think that just the underlying momentum that the United States has will carry it forward if they want to. And obviously right now, as we're watching what's happening in the US, you know, it's not clear they want to. And so then, yeah, I would count them out and yeah, China will pull forward. But I would never count out the US. Robert, what is the protocol for a large-scale asteroid impact? Could the U.S. president withhold intervention to leverage some sort of favor from the impacted country? So what is the protocol for large-scale asteroid impact? There is no protocol. The closest we have to a protocol is something called the Torino scale. That is where it was developed in Torino in Italy at some meeting of asteroid scientists. And this scale goes from 1 to 10, with 1 being like almost no risk, maybe a 20-meter asteroid that has a very slight chance of hitting the Earth at some point in the far future, to 10, which is a catastrophic asteroid that has a large chance of doing an enormous amount of damage to the planet. And, you know, we find various asteroids and they go on to the Torino scale because the timelines are very long. You know, you probably were all aware of asteroid 2024 YR4. You're probably all aware of asteroid Apophis. These are the kinds of asteroids that made it onto the Torino scale. And then astronomers focus their telescopes on these asteroids and they do more observations, and it brings the chance, the likelihood of that it's going to actually strike the Earth down to zero again, because they now understand that it is not a dangerous asteroid. It just was, you know, trying to be a dangerous asteroid. So what is the plan if one of these asteroids is potentially hazardous and dangerous? And right now there is no plan. There is no worldwide asteroid defense network, much to the terror and stress of people who think about this kind of thing. You know, there's the B612 Foundation, where they are trying to come up with a way that the world will come together to defend against potentially hazardous asteroids. But in bits and pieces, we have demonstrated, like with the DART mission, that we can reach out and push an asteroid out of the way if it is sufficiently urgent enough. But, you know, when you watch the movie Don't Look Up, which came out on Netflix a couple of years ago, you know, it was an allegory. Like, it was really talking about climate change. But the way they rolled out the discovery, the ongoing observations, the arguments of what to do about it, that all felt very real. And that's probably the phase that we're in right now, just because no one's willing to investigate and to spend the kind of resources for us to truly be able to get out there and push asteroids around. But, you know, could any one country withhold protection? I mean, unfortunately, an asteroid impact is a disaster that affects us all. I mean, even if it hits, you know, a 50-meter, 100-meter asteroid that hits some other country, it's going to cause an enormous amount of damage. It's going to put up a tremendous amount of dust into the atmosphere. It's going to cause worldwide effects for years, if not decades. It's a problem that we all will have to face. And the other good news is that there are plenty of other nations. China has the capability to reach out and push asteroids around. The European Space Agency probably has the ability to do it. And you can imagine private firms like SpaceX being able to do it as well. So, you know, we're in a place where if there is a risk, there's a lot of people that could come up with a solution. And so you don't have to sort of deal with the whims of any one nation. It's time to shout out our new patrons at the $5 level and above. Dave Schmidt, Mars Cubus, Tony Elmroth, Christian Robert, Cliff, Patricia Block, Austin Perman, Donello Flynn, John Thorpe, and Phil Brady. Join our community at patreon.com/universe today. Greg Smith, so I've been hearing that the universe might be older than 13.8 billion years. How old do you think it is? So I think it's really important to understand that when you hear one story that someone is saying that the scientific consensus is wrong and has been overturned, and in fact, the universe is twice as old as we thought, that's just one person. And they have proposed a theory, and that the rest of the scientific community has issues with the paper that has been published. And, you know, this is one that we've talked about a long time. You know, we've covered it here in the Question Show. We've covered it on Universe Today. And that is that, you know, if you are willing to accept a theory of light called tired light, that in fact, light redshifts with distance, not just with the expansion of the universe, then that could explain why the early galaxies seen in JWST appear to be more formed, more mature than you would expect that early on in the universe. But the problem is that the tired light theory has been debunked, and that it makes very specific predictions about what you should see in the universe, and those have failed to live up to the observation. And, you know, a lot of the time you get this, you know, like my job is to report space news. And so I see all of these press releases that come my way. I see all of the research papers. I look through journals every day and get a really good sense of what is the collective feeling by the astronomical community about various discoveries and various interesting mysteries that are unfolding right now. And there's no question that it's kind of weird that the early universe appears to be more fully formed, more mature than the original theories had predicted. Not you're going to have to throw all your theories in the trash, interesting, but that there's probably other factors here going on. We probably need to think about how, you know, is there some kind of confirmation bias in the way that we're observing these galaxies? This kind of a thing. And, you know, unfortunately, I mean, all I can do is run Universe Today, right? I can't run the other clickbaity space news organizations out there, but there is a tendency to hype up unsubstantiated claims, things that are not really accepted by the scientific community because it runs contrary. And I think there's like, people love the idea that the scientific consensus is wrong on anything, on everything, right? That the experts are wrong. That in fact, there's a plucky group of individuals who have realized that everything was wrong and they're going to come up with a breakthrough theory. And that just like, that doesn't happen very often. It happens, but mostly the scientific consensus very slowly, very painstakingly, with this tremendous amount of back and forth and battle, tears ideas apart, forces everybody to defend anything that they say so that they can try to center on what is truth, what is the true nature that reality is telling us. And unfortunately, someone will come out and say, you know, astronomers think that the universe is twice as old. Well, no, look, astronomers didn't think that. One researcher put out a paper that probably wasn't even peer-reviewed, maybe it was, that proposed this, but also had to incorporate a bunch of theories that have been overturned. That is not the scientific consensus. So, you know, like the best advice that I ever got on this, I think, comes from Dr. Paul Sutter. You know, if you haven't checked out his channel, Ask a Spaceman, he's terrific. He's one of the writers on Universe Today, but he's also an incredible, you know, podcaster. He sees videos. Anyway, his thing that he says is that if it's interesting, it's probably wrong. And that, you know, often when people find things, electromagnetic drives, that the neutrino moves faster than the speed of light, that the universe is twice as old as we thought, that dark energy is changing over time, you know, that don't get excited. Like, assume that this thing is going to be overturned shortly. And now you're just going to wait for that and be, but also hopeful that this interesting thing actually will turn out to be true. And then maybe this, you know, the dark energy changing over time, this is getting more and more interesting. The evidence is growing. The scientific consensus is starting to shift to a different explanation for dark energy. That's really exciting. And that's how this process works. So, you know, just like obviously with that one thing, the scientific consensus is not that the universe is twice as old as we thought. But like just in general, when you hear this kind of stuff, I hope that there's a circuit in your brain that goes, ooh, that's interesting, and probably wrong. Ian Whitworth, can we mine the moon for helium? So I guess you're asking here, can we mine the moon for helium-3, which is an isotope of helium that is very rare on Earth, but could be plentiful on the moon, on the surface of the moon, because it is being hurled at the moon and the Earth from the sun through the solar wind. And so on Earth, this stuff is very rare, but it's been building up into the regolith, the top area of the regolith on the moon for billions of years. And so someone could go and set up a lunar harvesting operation and just scrape off the top of the regolith on the moon. And then you would be able to pull out that sweet, sweet helium-3 for all of your fusion needs. Now, what makes helium good, or helium-3 good for fusion, is that it's able to produce a version of fusion that doesn't give off a lot of radioactivity. So when you think about traditional deuterium, tritium here on Earth, the kinds of fusion that is mostly being explored because we have access to lots of deuterium and tritium, that is a very radioactive process. And so you're going to have your fusion plant that's going to be going, it's going to be throwing out tons and tons of radioactive particles. They are going to increase the radioactivity of the structure itself. And if there's a way that you can do that with less radioactivity, that would be super duper. And so people have thought, well, one thing that the moon has that the Earth doesn't have is helium-3. Let's go get it. Now, there's a couple of issues. The first issue is that we don't know how to do regular fusion in a way that is sustainable and profitable. That, you know, the easiest, simplest version that we can imagine right now is a giant torus magnetic containment facility where plasma is heated up to incredible temperatures, contained, and then you're able to then generate fusion power from that. We don't know how to do that yet. Now, there are some really interesting experiments. People have gotten very, very close to figuring this out. There's ITER in Europe. There's another reactor that's in Germany. The Chinese are working on their version of this. And so probably in the next 30 years, they always say, fusion will be cracked. And then when fusion is cracked, with deuterium, they'll probably move on to tritium. And then when tritium is cracked, then they might move on to helium-3. But we are decades, half century away from needing helium-3 for that even being feasible. But when we do, then we'll have to do a cost-benefit analysis and think, well, if we want to get helium-3 down here on Earth, we have to filter the ocean, or we have to access enormous amounts of petrochemicals which have helium locked into it, and some small percentage of that is going to be helium-3. Does it make more sense to go and get it from the moon? You're still, like, it's the moon, and it's very far away, and it's very expensive to get to. So it's going to be really tricky to get all the way to the moon to harvest up. But there's a great movie called Moon, which is about that, with Sam Rockwell, and I highly recommend it. So watch that movie, and then you can decide if you want to mine helium from the moon. Did you know you can watch the same video with no ads and get a bonus question over on Patreon completely for free? We call it Q&A Plus. This week's bonus question is all about what will be my favorite telescope now that Gaia is gone. And I'll put a link in the show notes so you can watch that. All right, those are all the questions that we had this week. Thank everyone who asked your questions in the YouTube comments, as well as everybody who showed up for the live show. Now, just a reminder, we do the live show Mondays, but the actual time rotates week after week after week. So sometimes it's Pacific Standard Time, sometimes it's European time, and sometimes it's for the Australasian time. And so you're going to want to go and find the event here on the channel. There'll be one here that'll show you when the next one is going to happen. All right, I'm going to chat about some smaller YouTubers, but first I'd like to thank our patrons. Thanks to Abe Kingston, Andrew M. Gross, Bailey Groofing, Brian Bodie, Caredwin, Chuck Hawkins, Commander Baylock, Cy Nielsen, David Gilton, David Matz, Dustin Cable, Evan Pro, Greg Feely, Hans Schultz, Hudson Ward, Jay Graves, James Clark, Jeremy Mattern, Jim Burke, Jordan Young, Marcel Smits, Michael Purcell, Modsil, Paul Robuck, Ren Kaidu, Robeck, Sean Sargent, Stanislav Zarjev, Stephen Fowler-Menley, Thomas L. Skadron, Vlad Shiplin, and Wolfgang Klotz, who support us at the Master of the Universe level. And all our patrons, all your support means universe to us. A couple of weeks ago, I asked for your help to find YouTubers who just don't have enough subscribers, even though they're producing what is very compelling content. And it was surprising to me because people were recommending channels that have more subscribers than me. People get way more views than even my videos do. So please, like, if you've got some names, like, I want people who have less than 10,000 subscribers. If you can find me gems with less than 1,000 subscribers, I will be grateful. Those are the people that we can really help shout out, get them across that first line where you can get monetization and more. So I'm going to give you three people that I found that sort of fit that criteria. So the first one is a woman named Constanza Palestri, and she is a fairly established YouTuber and has a bunch of channels, one in Italian and then does one in English and does sort of various video essays and writing and stuff. But she actually went back and got her master's degree in physics and is now started up a new channel all about the history of science and physics. And this is something that's a really fascinating sort of field to me. I love the sort of the history of the scientific method and sort of how we came about the types of theories that we have today. And I've, you know, she's only got three videos on the channel, but I can tell she's going to be really huge. And I think less than 1,000 subscribers when I found her. And so this channel is called The Strange Loop. The next channel is all about astrophotography, and this comes from a guy in Slovenia named Matej Mlakar. And his pictures are amazing. Like, he's a really accomplished astrophotographer, and he does a lot of really great tutorials on how you can go out and get the shots and how you can do the processing afterwards, and showed exactly how you can, for example, do these really cool composite images of Andromeda above a mountain peak and try to sort of bring out all of the different bits and elements in that picture. And again, like, less than 1,000 subscribers, and the quality of his work is so good. So I'll put a link to his channel in the show notes. And then the last one, and I've actually had a couple of people recommend his channel before. His name is Paul Fellows, and he does these sort of YouTube-based PowerPoint presentations about interesting objects in astronomy. And he does this once around series where he will talk about once around various moons or planets or interesting stars and sort of just kind of cover that thing from all aspects. And so if you're looking for a way to kind of get up to speed on different concepts in space and astronomy, I highly recommend you check that out. And once again, his name is Paul Fellows. And once again, I will put links to all of these channels in the show notes. So again, I challenge you, find me people who are doing great science communication here on YouTube who have less than 10,000 subscribers. Less than 1,000 subscribers would be great so that I can really try and help lend my channel's voice to their work. All right, we will see you next week.